listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A day after the historic meeting between Presidents Putin and Trump in Helsinki, the corporate media and social media were abuzz. For more on all of this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer on international relations at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow, Tuesday.
The news cycle, things are happening so fast now. Not only with this whole Trump Putin or Russiagate, however you want to term it, you know, but in so many things now that it's difficult to keep up with the news cycle, and one thing simply replaces another faster than you can catch your breath.
Yeah.
It seems like an entire year ago that Trump announced the Supreme Court nominee pick,
and
no one's even talking about it at this point because it's been completely swept under everything else, which of course may very well be in someone's calculation
at some point.
Things are buried under other things and buried under other things intentionally. You know, it would be impossible to know the exact chicken and egg scenario there.
Yeah.
But I think it's noteworthy that going directly into the summit out of the NATO meeting, out of this fractious NATO meeting that we discussed, and a quite hostile visit by Trump to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Hostile on both sides.
Yeah, mutually hostile. Yeah.
Mutually hostile. Both from the public and from the politicians on both sides. That Trump made comments to the press referring to the European Union as a foe. And perhaps the greatest threat facing the United States, and I think that deserves some analysis. going into this the wider thing with with the summit. Because first of all, we have to say again that you know Trump is you know he's not the smartest tool in the shed. Certainly not for a politician. That probably not even for a businessman. He's not necessarily thinking, certainly not along the lines of most geopolitical strategists or, you know, even international relations experts, foreign policy experts, you know, that make up the U.S. blob, the foreign policy and the geopolitical strategic establishment. He is a businessman. And first, I would say that he thinks in terms of being a businessman. And again, I'm not counting for his qualifications on that regard because they're quite mixed. But he thinks of a balance sheet. He thinks of things coming in and out. And on that balance sheet, one of the things he's primarily looking at is trade deficits.
Right.
I mean, he is looking at other countries. He doesn't see military, geopolitical. That's not the first thing on his mind. He thinks in terms of economics and, again, the reduction of it to business terms, which is perhaps one argument why a businessman shouldn't be running the United States because or any country because a country is not a business. I think that's a little more than a little dangerously reductionist. Mm-hmm. But Trump sees trade deficits with the EU, and he sees that as something that has to be reversed. That is his primary goal, particularly. As he, I think to some extent, rightly sees himself elected by the population of the United States that has not benefited from global capitalist, neoliberal capitalist globalization, you know, the left outs of globalization.
Right. Yep.
You know, the ones that the liberals don't even want to acknowledge that anyone hasn't benefited from globalization, which is part of their problem.
Those deplorables you're talking about. Yeah.
If you want to call people who were unemployed by globalization deplorable, that's fine. You know, certainly some of Trump's supporters are deplorable. There's plenty of deplorable Clinton supporters. You know, lots of people would consider me deplorable. So
you've got Capitol Hill if you want to go farm deplorable.
That's a nonsense word, right? But certainly that is a big part of Trump's is the globalization disenfranchised, if you want to call it that. And so he sees himself going about, of course, trying to do what he delivered to that base. Of course, part of that calculus being so that he can stay in office, win the midterm elections, and perhaps win re-election, which he has announced that he will try to seek, much, I'm sure, to the horror of the Republican Party. But he's looking at these balance sheets and he sees huge trade deficits with the EU, and he regards them not just as a competitor, but as a foe. He sees them as taking advantage of the U.S., not only in terms of trade, but in terms of defense spending with NATO and all of these. And there are arguments to be made there, and he's not the first one to have made these arguments. Obama, actually, at a much lower rhetorical level, made the same arguments to NATO countries to try to get them to raise their spending. He just didn't raise it to the same level and pitch that Trump did. Another thing that I think is essential in Trump's calculus of looking at the world so differently from previous U.S. presidents is simply a personality. He was basically, let's say, the leaders of the EU ran against him.
They did. That's right.
They did. Several of them, including the Italian prime minister and others, openly endorsed Hillary Clinton in the campaign.
I remember that.
Those that didn't made a lot of comments that could easily be interpreted that way.
Yeah.
And also, their state medias. I'm looking particularly at German state media in Deutsche Welle and others. BBC were clearly biased to an extreme degree against Trump, right, and in support of Hillary Clinton. this all goes to what Trump sees himself as, persecuted by these people. He feels personally offended by them. He feels he was under attack by them. He sees that as meddling in U.S. politics.
Yeah, for sure.
Depending on what your definition of meddling is today, which is, you know, might very, you know, Facebook memes might be meddling. Well, then certainly this would qualify as well. And then that doesn't even take us to involvement like the British intelligence services and government with this dodgy dossier and things, which were approved by the British government and compiled by a quote X unquote British spy. Yeah. There could be some things within this rather lurid document that are true, but it's quite obvious that certainly the more salacious parts of it are simply intended as opposition slander, opposition research, that being what this document was. Right. And he sees that as coming from the British government, and by extension, much of the rest of the EU. He sees them as his personal enemies,
yeah.
And he wants a little bit of payback. And is that the right way to run a country, or for a president to act? No, of course not. But that's Trump.
Is it novel? Is it a novel way to run a country? I don't think so.
And I agree. Others probably have done the same, although probably not to the same obvious public animus and intensity that Trump right. has. So going into this summit, he refers to the EU as a foe of the United States. He also there was a very interesting characterization going into the summit where he said he saw Russia as a competitor.
Yeah, the whole thing. Russia. Yeah, there was like a whole language class, I guess, or whatever, yes, adjustment on foe, competitor, enemy, like that.
Yeah, John McCain got up literally, evidently, off of his deathbed and screamed, having been transcribed by the media, I guess, that Russia is not just our competitor, that it is our enemy.
Right.
And the EU is not our foe.
Right.
The Russian presidential spokesman, supposedly Peskov, supposedly speaking for Putin, then chimed in a little bit afterwards that it didn't view that Putin didn't view Trump as a competitor, that he viewed him as a partner.
Right.
And
ooh,
yeah.
God help us.
Certainly it didn't help in the context of Trump's domestic politics, although
right.
that's certainly not the Kremlin's primary concern. It yep. may have been intending at some level to butter him up, of course, going into the summit. But at another level, I think that this is what you could actually call Russia trolling the United States.
I mean, maybe, but you know what? Is it trolling to speak sensible, plain language just because everybody around you is talking insanity? Or is that something that helps to orient people like, oh, that's where their ground is. Let me land now and try walking for a while.
Yeah. As an immigrant to Russia, let me just completely disagree with you, Don, there. That is not sensible, clear language. Russia and the United States are not the partners
of each
other.
Right, that's
true.
I'm
a little sick of Putin referring to, countries that are killing Russians
in
Syria and other
as partners,
whether right. we're talking Turkey, the right. United States, Saudi Arabia, others. I'm a little sick of hearing about our partners.
Right. Who's conducting those war games on our borders? Oh, it's our partners. Never mind. Yeah, right.
That is diplomatic language. That is diplomatic language. But sometimes Russians wish for a little bit more fire out of their president. He is a cold-blooded operative and pragmatist. And some ways, that may be better. But sometimes people do just want to hear a little bit more blunt honesty.
Yeah.
And, well, in the United States, they elected Trump because of that.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
And which is, of course, a cautionary note to those who want to see Putin removed from office in the United States, because I guarantee that Zhirinovsky or Zhuganov would not suit you better.
And those are
the two closest rivals.
That's right.
So this What do you think of this summit, Don? Let me think. Get your what's your takeaway?
Well, okay. Look, the media here started to have and by when you see the media take a wall to wall position, you can be pretty sure, given the nature of the ownership of the media in the United States, that position is the position of whatever you want to call the deep elite here, the guys who are in charge. If the media is going wall to wall with a single point, you can bet that the guys in charge want that point sold.
Yeah, coming out of this, when I saw John Brennan and Clapper and others now heading right out of the heads of U.S. intelligence agencies into the media, where they are the pundits feeding us our propaganda directly, not even going through the usual business of leaks to the media and so on. But I now view this as a media deep state intelligence complex.
You know, if you take a look at the first and second Iraq wars, the way there were exoduses of generals from the military into retirement and punditship right away, and wall-to-wall punditry from ex-generals, the same thing that you have going on now might tell you something about the nature of what's going on now. If the media is selling this, you can tell that that's the elite's point of view. And they started selling it hardcore, and covering Trump not as a an odd phenomenon, that guy who you're fired, et cetera, the guy who walks through a movie next to the mermaid, or whatever, but instead as a real threat and danger, not because of the things he had said 20, 30 years ago, although they started invoking those things, but rather when he started to talk about NATO being obsolete. And let's not do this regime change thing. It doesn't work. The moment he spoke those words, suddenly became a pariah to the media wall to wall. And
notice it wasn't his neoliberal economic policies or even his
immigration
absurd denial of climate change science or anything like that. It was simply he proposed a non-hegemonic foreign policy.
Okay, going into the Democratic Convention, as a matter of fact, and coming out of it ever since, the rallying point for everything from block him at the Electoral College to go carry him out of the White House and string him up has not been climate change, immigration, misogyny, all these things. They throw that stuff at him, but that's not the rallying cry. The hearings are about Russia.
Yeah.
Okay? The hearings, and now the calls, people calling him a traitor. Okay, that's a crime, being a traitor, that results in execution.
The former director of the CIA,
right.
John Brennan, from his now paid position as a pundit on CNN, tweeted that Trump's activities were worse than high crimes and misdemeanors and were treasonous.
Yep.
And after a few seconds of cheering and the immediate onslaught of retweets and everything, some people actually, some serious establishment people, started to take a step back and say, whoa. You're going to make accusations like that. Let's slow down and provide an actual legal argument why you think that is the case.
Yeah, some facts,
even Ian Bremmer, the head of the Eurasia Group, which is, one of the lead establishment figures determining U.S. Foreign policy from within think tanks, or at least collaborating on the formation of it, when even he is pulling back a little bit.
That tells you something. You're right. Absolutely true.
Yep.
So knowing, seeing all of this, okay, and watching the outcry yesterday, what really, two things. One, back and forth, I've been wondering is Trump for real on this stuff, or is this some kind of footsie game that they're playing? Is it, because what they're doing, the whole political constellation in the United States, for better or worse, is I won't even say it's been reconfigured, because it sounds like after being smashed to smithereens, it's been reformed, and it's not being, it hasn't been reformed. It's like almost atomic. Each person's got some crazy little, fractal of political information that makes them hate just about everybody else, and they're all going absolutely insane. So there's no political constituency, for example, and this is what I was complaining about on Facebook after seeing everything, there, people talk about an anti-war movement in the United States, an anti-war movement. Well, right now you have the president of the United States saying, you know what, we've been at the precipice of war with Russia. There's no reason for it whatsoever. It's our own fault for being stupid. And let's stop doing it and make friends. And the entire establishment is standing up and saying, no, you can't do that. You're a traitor. That would be a place where I would think the anti-war movement ought to insert itself into the public discussion. And there's not even a discussion of them doing that.
No, in fact, the opposite. We actually have a pro-war movement right now, pretty much baying for war with Russia at some level. Yep. I always wonder, what do these people, you know, that are constantly on this resistance, Neil McCarthy angle, what do they actually want here? Do they want conventional nuclear confrontation with Russia? Do they want U.S. agents, I don't know, going back to the Soviet Union and detonating pipelines inside Russia? Do they want assassinations? Maybe. I mean, the U.S. has drone assassinations, has assassinated thousands of the people around the world. Do they actually want to get into that kind of competition with Russia, though, that can actually hit back on, like, say, jihadis in Pakistan? I'm just curious.
It's amazing.
And cyber warfare, let's not pretend the U.S. is an innocent victim in this regard. Whether we're talking the exposure of Pentagon sock puppet armies, to spread disinformation under false identities online, interfere in other countries' political process, to the meddling to the actual cyber warfare attacks using engineered viruses like Stuxnet that attacked Iranian nuclear facilities built. In cooperation, built by Russia as it is in Iran, these are pretty extreme cyber warfare activities. Do we really want to take it to the next level? Because we know that both Russia and the U.S. have pretty much openly, we're aware that they have the ability to take down each other's infrastructure, like power networks, energy infrastructure, for sure. And I'm sure a lot more. Russia keeps asking the United States to sit down like we did in the Cold War and set rules for the game. And one of the big things they keep asking for is a cyber warfare treaty to establish, rules of this game. And the U.S. keeps refusing.
Right.
Primarily because they actually are the world's biggest cyber warfare aggressor.
Yeah, let's not forget who designed the internet. I mean, the internet was is DARPANET, it's Defense Advanced Research Project.
Yeah, it wasn't Al Gore. We have to say that
it wasn't Al Gore. No,
he did craft some legislation which had a part to play in all of it, but no, it wasn't Al Gore. You're right. I think the kernel of it certainly was with DARPA.
Yeah.
So, what they really want is Trump to be impeached.
Yep.
Humiliated, disgraced, jailed, him and all his administration. But of course, there isn't actually any legal basis for that. After years of FBI investigation, we get a bunch of Russians unconnected, even as they announce it in any way with Russia, that can't be. They announce allegations, because that's what indictments are, against them, with no evidence presented, knowing because there is no extradition treaty with Russia, because the U.S. refuses to sign one. Russia would like to have one, because there's quite a few Chechen jihadi warlords that are being harbored in the United States that Russia would like to have extradited, and the U.S. keeps refusing to extradite those. They'll never have to face extradition. So Mueller at least assumes he will never have to face any of these or present any such evidence in court. Although, interestingly, in the first set of indictments against these, 10 or 13 Russian supposedly trolls from this internet research agency that were waging Facebook meme war on the United States, I guess. And I don't know how to take this seriously, especially considering what the U.S. gets up to in meddling in other countries. But The Internet Research Agency has actually sent a representative to the United States saying, we're gonna appear in court.
Yep.
And now Mueller is trying to keep evidence out of court.
See, they screwed up. I knew this the moment I saw that indictment and I saw that there were corporate defendants. I said, well, don't these idiots realize if you indict a corporation, they don't have to send, like, the guy to court where they can be arrested and, you know, stuck in jail for 1,000 years. They can appear by counsel. And once they appear, they can do a discovery demand and say,
yes,
show us your case and show us all the evidence that supports your case.
And now Mueller is trying to delay the trial.
He's like,
and
oops.
Keep that evidence from being presented.
That's right.
Maybe, because he doesn't have any evidence to be presented.
That would be my guess.
Yeah. Maybe they actually got called on that one. We'll see. But so I don't know really what these people want. But let's talk about the performance of the two in the summer. First of all, other than what happened privately between the two of them in this 2 hours and 10 minutes, they supposedly talked with no one except translators in the room, which has the Western media and commentariat in such a frothing terror. I honestly, if you just listen to the tone of the media, U.S. media going into, not only the U.S., actually the Western media going into the summit, if you just read the tone and not the details, you might very well think that there was a serious question of whether an asteroid was going to hit the Earth tomorrow or yesterday. I mean, it was apocalyptic. The tone was ridiculously apocalyptic. Yeah. And of course, nothing actually came out of this. No substantive contracts or deals were announced. Certainly there was no preparatory work. There were no deliverables presented and signed by both parties that usually happens at such summits. It was largely a PR event. Trump thinks he's going to gain domestically going into midterms out of this, I have no idea. I really can't fathom his rationale. I mean, is he trying to confront the whole Russiagate things head on rather than trying to, you know, downplay it, I guess? Is that part of his rationale? Because, you know, most of his supporters do not love him because of his position of wanting to improve relations with Russia, both in his original campaign or now. Americans, simply for the majority, they don't vote on foreign policy.
Right.
And certainly you're not going to look at the Republican base and say, oh, these are people that naturally want to improve relations with Russia. No, of course not.
Although I was shocked to see the contrary exhibited at the RNC in 2016, when he talked about that and talked about no regime change, they got up and gave him a standing ovation. The Republican, basically the apparatus of the Republican Party, assembled in a basketball stadium.
Just a few years earlier, that when Mitt Romney called Russia the biggest enemy of the United States, they did the same thing.
4 years earlier.
I think this is just partisan.
It may well be. Part of it to me, because it's significant, what happened in the intervening period between 2012 and 2016, I have no idea what the impact is on the collective psyche of people here, of that distant fear of, you know, global incineration that we had when we were kids, that, you know, kind of gone away over the last 25 years, suddenly gets restoked. Now, I don't know if that has an impact on people or not, but that's in the background of you know, the political life here between 2012 and Romney and 2016 and Trump. So who knows?
Mm-hmm. So Putin's performance was his usual, completely controlled. There's no question that he has a degree of ability, as he was a former intelligence operative and has been very smooth in establishing relations with other leaders around the world on his terms. He certainly has the ability to manipulate other leaders to his advantage. I think he is an excellent study in that regard. You know, there's nothing particularly sinister. I think people want that out of any leader.
Yeah, it's a job description.
Yeah. You know, he's good at it. And I think he certainly tried to play Trump for everything he was worth. And, you know, that certainly the Russian people are very appreciative of that, if the American people are not. Trump's performance was, I would have to say, absolutely incoherent and unhinged.
Yeah, it was a little flat-footed, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, when he starts railing on and on again with this obvious insecurity complex he has, no doubt due to the, you know, the Russiagate witch hunt, justifying his election and how much he beat Hillary Clinton by, and the electoral, started going into the Electoral College. And I just have to imagine what was going on in Putin's mind.
He was looking at him when he was saying that stuff.
Are we a little off in the weeds here?
Yeah, let's get back to the important stuff, like how we're not blowing the world up. You know?
Was he enjoying it at some part, watching the leader of the U.S. stand next to him, devolve next to the collected leader of Russia? Or did he feel pity for him? We don't know.
These are things about Trump that people have been saying, even while he was running, that, you know, I wish he wouldn't tweet at night, I wish he'd keep his mouth shut, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out, whatever the hell he was doing, whatever that mixture of things was that he was doing, whatever alchemy that was, he won the election. And so I'm wondering if maybe he knows something that we don't know looking at him, and that, you know, maybe Putin's looking at either that or just looking at him saying, damn, I feel bad for your brother. I can't believe you got to do this stuff every day because of these people. We're out of time.
Putin did make some comments about some money transfers to the Clinton campaign going through Bill Browder and some other interesting things.
He said $400 million.
It's very interesting that, of course, the Western media is not even looking into that in the slightest.
There could be a translation problem, because the translator could have heard 400,000 and thought million because of the way the language works. But
I don't know. But, you know, Bill Browder changed his citizenship to the UK specifically so he didn't have to pay U.S. taxes. So if he's in any way contributing to the Clinton campaign,
that's right, that's
whatever the source of that money. Seems more British meddling.
That's right. You're absolutely right. All right. So we're out of time. Mark, thank you very much. We'll speak with you late this week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The very idea of a Trump-Putin summit was controversial from the start. They met in Helsinki and essentially agreed the U.S. and Russia should at least engage in dialogue to start a process of mending a very damaged relationship. Much of the media and the foreign policy swamp reacted with an apocalyptic meltdown. Has the establishment lost its mind? Crosstalking the Helsinki Summit, I'm joined by my guest, Michael O'Hanlon in Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also in Washington, we have Daniel Faraci. He is the director of Grassroots Political Consulting. And in London, we cross to Mary Dashevsky. She's a columnist for The Independent and Guardian. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mary, let me go to you first in London. I guess your most important takeaway impression of the summit in Helsinki, and what was accomplished? 2 points. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I think the most important thing was that it happened at all. I was one of the people who was actually quite in favour of it happening and felt that it should have happened much closer to the beginning of Donald Trump's presidency. And I'm sorry that it wasn't. As to what it achieved, I think that's probably best summed up in a phrase that President Putin used in his initial statement, where he talked about first steps. And I think it was probably unrealistic to expect anything more than first steps. But I think at least that was accomplished. But of course, in the 24 hours after the summit, and after the press conference, I mean, what we've seen has been a complete demolition from Washington. I mean, personally, I'm just amazed looking at the US response, or at least probably what is better called the response of the Washington political establishment.
Yeah, the swamp, that's what I call it. Okay, Michael, the same 2 points to you. I mean, the most important impression you had, and what was accomplished, if anything? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, first, Peter, greetings from the swamp. I'm sitting here in Washington. And second, congratulations to Russia. And congratulations on an amazing World Cup. We all enjoyed that around the world. And I think it's worth emphasizing such points, even on a serious political talk show.
Well, thank you, Michael, because
the kind of things that bring us
together, in Moscow, we did not feel very isolated from the world. OK, so thank you very much. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Sure.
Go ahead. My 2 points on the summit. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then secondly, I agree with Mary's main point. I think that it was good to have a summit. I do regret that our president, President Trump, probably did not handle the question about the 2016 elections very well. I understand why he doesn't want to get into that in a press conference where he's trying to sustain a positive vibe with President Putin. But I think he should have therefore given a non-answer rather than what we consider in the United States to be a wrong answer. And that unfortunately did take the entire political commentary, really on both sides of the political aisle here in Washington, in a negative direction against President Trump, not so much against President Putin, not so much against whatever substance may have been discussed privately, but against that particular handling of the 2016 election issue. I hope we can move beyond that, because I would like to view this, as Mary says, as at least baby steps towards a better relationship.
Well, you know, Daniel, you know, it seems that, you know, I mean, Trump is accused of coddling enemies and dissing friends. But, you know, the U.S. media essentially coddled Vladimir Putin and demonized the president of the United States. Those questions, and I saw the preview before the presser, like Jim Acosta, people like that, they already had their knives out. They weren't going to listen to the presser. They were just going to ask questions as if they were in Washington, D.C. They had no interest in what the two presidents had to say. They went there, and I'm afraid, and I'm going to agree with Michael, Trump fell for it. He shouldn't have. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I would say Washington would have woken up to a neocon nightmare no matter what happened. There didn't even need to be a press conference. This was all a foregone conclusion. I will agree with Mary as well. I am pleased that this took place. I'm also pleased that a great World Cup was pulled off as well. But, you know, this the language today is against President Trump and it against Putin as well. All across the media, you watch Morning Joe and it just on and on and on for hours across the channels. Fox News is inflamed, CNN. And there's this short history and memory of President Bush and Vladimir Putin having a good summit together, trying to, and at that time, there was the possibility of Russian involvement in the European Union and NATO itself. President Obama and Medvedev on their famous on-camera or off-camera cordial relationship back and forth. Hillary Clinton and the reset. But because this is Trump, and because there's actually a chance at dialogue and progressive steps being made on Syria, on Ukraine, and on other issues, this has lit up this town, regardless of what happened in the press conference.
Yeah, it seems it has little to do with what actually happened in Helsinki. Let me go to Mary here. We have former CIA Director John Brennan, quote, Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki was treasonous. He is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? We have James Comey. Wow. I mean, you know, oh, Lordy, James Comey. Oh, my goodness. He says patriots need to stand up and reject the behavior of this president. Are they calling for a coup like they pulled off in Ukraine in 2014? Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I think they're probably calling for something a lot short of that. But I think what is behind what they said, I mean, aside from being a sort of knee-jerk reaction, that they regarded what Donald Trump said as being as betraying the, as it were, the good name and expertise of the United States. Now, both of them are hardly friends of Donald Trump now. So to an extent, they were cheerleading, or at least whatever the opposite of cheerleading is, in Washington against Trump. But I think there is a real problem here. What was Donald Trump supposed to do when confronted with what was going to be the inevitable question?
Exactly.
Because although, you know, what's been said is, well, he should have given a non-answer. Well, Trump, you know, very often he's not diplomatic in that way. He doesn't really specialise in non-answers. And so I think there is a real problem. What was he supposed to say?
Yeah.
From his perspective, was he supposed to say, oh, no, you know, now I believe all these claims that Russia interfered in our election and colluded with my team to get me elected? Or was he going to say, which has been his position all along, that he actually rejects these claims, even though a section, not all, but a section of U.S. intelligence actually supports them.
You know, Michael, the thing is that I agree with Mary, but obviously Trump is not a man of nuance. Okay, I think all of us would agree with that, and everyone watching this program here. But what kind of answer was he supposed to demand from Putin? I mean, he could say, "I listened to what he had to say, but we have to move on." Because I mean, it's a bit rich, Michael, when the United States for the last 70 some years have been throwing elections, undermining democracy, installing governments. I mean, all over the world, and so the Russian military or counterintelligence. They kind of poked around. I mean, it's part of their job. They would be remiss if they didn't do it. Okay, I don't understand it, this kind of moral outrage that someone might do what we do to the whole world all the time. Go ahead, Michael.
First of all, Peter, I think you have accurately explained the way that, for example, President Putin probably looks at this problem. Whatever he may have authorized in 2016, and I believe he did authorize meddling in the U.S. election.
We have no evidence of that.
Though
we have no evidence of that, right?
But
Peter, we have no evidence,
Peter,
though.
I just told you what I think.
Okay.
I think we have pretty good evidence, but I'd rather just accept your point that what you're doing is describing a worldview which has some basis of history behind it, because you're right. Historically, I don't believe this happens in this way anymore, but historically, the United States, like the Soviet Union during the Cold War, both engineered a number of changes of government and certainly were very interested in shaping the politics of a lot of countries around the world. And we still do that, although I think by more overt, transparent means, even today. President Putin thinks he's just reciprocating. I genuinely believe that's how he looks at the problem. But what I would have suggested that President Trump say is, I'm not here to talk about 2016, but we do have to harden our democracy against any effort by foreign interference from any source
for
2018 and
2020. Or maybe Democrats, or maybe protected from the Democratic National Committee, maybe protect America's democracy that way as well. All right, let me go to
what I was driving at, but you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, if there was anything rigged in the 2016 election, talk to Bernie Sanders about it. All right, Daniel, let me go to you and we'll finish off this part of the program. Go ahead.
I would say this will continue, of course, our tension and Russia phobia. There's a refusal from the foundation of this to accept Russia, not as the Soviet Union, down to even the language. They don't talk today about President Trump and Putin being like Medvedev and Obama and Bush and Putin. It's all in the terms of Kennedy and Nixon and these grand Soviet meetings. The World Cup is another way of, how dare we see that you guys are in the 21st century. The second part of it being, on the summit, like I had said, the press conference could have happened or not, and this would have ended up in the same level of tension. And the irony is, at the point that you made, Peter, we meddle, and in fact, everyone's saying today, Trump should have said, if you meddle in 18 or 20, our relationship's over. Well, how about right here at the National Prayer Breakfast, only a few months ago in Washington, D.C., there was a fundraiser held for Putin's opposition, right at a same conference where President Trump was speaking. So we meddle and interfere all over the world, and this is a big, the large powers do. But, President, it could have been brought right back from Putin to Trump about how overt you know, raising money and giving a forum to his opposition candidate, how much more blatant of interference can you get than that?
Okay, we're going to go to a break here, but, you know, the interesting thing is that I don't think it actually has much to do with Russia anymore. It has to do with impeachment. That's what it looks like to me. All right, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Helsinki summit. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Mary in London. And so we finished the first half of the program here. It seems to me, and I'm going to express my opinion, is that no collusion has been proven. Actually, the last indictment actually should make that clear. Rod Rosenstein, why he announced it to the public is a mystery to me. I don't think he should have done that. But nonetheless, so collusion is kind of off the table. Okay, obstruction of justice, that's pretty dicey, too. But Russia... treason. And this is what we're getting. Treason. When a political culture starts using that term very loosely, you know you're in trouble here. And this is something from The Atlantic. James Fallows. And this is where it's going. This is the moment of truth for Republicans. The GOP can either defend the United States or serve the damaged and defective man who is now its president. And this is their... going into the midterms election, this is what they want to do. They want to start picking off moderate Republicans as they go into the election here. It's because Donald Trump is a traitor. That's their new message here. I think that's disgusting, okay? When you start questioning other people's patriotism, you know you're in a bad place. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I think those were the very extreme comments from the extreme end of people who were talking after the press conference. I think that in one respect, maybe they reflect the views of people who still hope against hope that there may possibly be grounds for impeachment. And obviously, we're looking at the sort of pre-run-up to the midterm elections, and I think that's entirely right. But what I find very difficult to gauge from here is I understand the mood in Washington, and to a lesser extent I understand it, as it were, on the coasts and the Democratic-dominated coasts. But I wonder how much Trump's natural constituency, heartland America, is going to respond to all this. Do you think it's going to pick up the idea that the president they elected is actually disloyal to his to his own people? Or are they going to say, no, the establishment it's the establishment that's betrayed us, not the president?
You know, Mary, it's really interesting. I've been saying over the last few weeks here, and I viewers will know it, I think that Trump has this envelope in his pocket, and he pulls it out after every single promise has been kept. I met Putin. Okay, check. Supreme Court justice, check. Jobs, tariffs, check, check, check. It's not about America first. It's about Donald Trump first. Okay, and as far as the heartland, this whole Russiagate nonsense, for them, it's essentially nonsense. It's a stick to beat the president, and it's the liberal media that does it. So I think that's already answered. Let me go to Michael, because Michael and I fundamentally disagree on almost every single thing, okay, except for the World Cup was great. But I'm going to be friendly to my friend Michael, because I think one of the things I think is so tragic is that you've been mentioning, at least on the margins, you know, the essentials behind the case for Russia did meddle in the election. And you know what? I think you're a good, honorable man, and you believe what you say. But people like myself actually believe, I actually believe what I say too. And this is the loggerhead that we have come into. And I think disagreement is really, really good. And we have a good banter. But I'm not going to say that you're a traitor to your own country because you disagree with me. And I think this is what's happening right now in the U.S., and that can lead to no good end. Go ahead, Michael.
No, I agree with you on that point. I think Mr. Brennan, who's a very honorable man and an important man in our country because he was a CIA director, he really would have been better advised not to use that word. He could have been very, very scathing in his critique of the specific sentence that Donald Trump used in regard to this 2016 issue. I think he could have been very tough on that particular point. But one thing I learned a long time ago, even before getting into public policy debates and television, is when you're going to criticize somebody, criticize a specific thing they did or a specific word and give them a chance, therefore, to make amends. Don't try to make it about the broader character. Now, Donald Trump does invite debate about his character because we know he is a very controversial, polarizing figure. So it becomes almost a temptation. But I think it's a temptation that people are better off trying to resist. Be specific in your criticisms. That's the way I try to operate with this or any other president.
You know, Daniel, okay, I'm going to get real partisan again right now. You know, I looked at, you know, James Comey comes out with a message, Brennan comes out. I wonder if Peter Strzok has been talking about this here. I mean, I can understand how Donald Trump, I mean, he's been in office, you know, 500 days plus, you know, and he's still having to have to deal with, when is Brennan going to be deposed? When is he going to be questioned? Okay, I would like to know that. Okay, there's a number of very thoughtful, smart people that think that Brennan could be one of the primary movers behind this fake conspiracy. I mean, it seems to me that he's projecting so much because he has a lot to answer for, and he won't because everybody wraps themselves up on the flag on this one, and that's where it gets really dicey. Go ahead, Daniel.
Also, Brennan has been chastised by his own colleagues, Senate Democrats, for lying to Congress as well. And nothing ever came of that on critical intelligence testimony, both behind closed doors and overtly. This is interesting. The part you're bringing into the politics of this, the base, Trump... thing I'll give him the most credit in the world as a lifelong Democrat turned into a Tea Party evangelical baby boomer Fox News viewer, you know, individual as a politician.
Good for you.
He knows his base. He knows his base better than anybody. That's why he tweets the red meat to them. I think that checklist you have, we're going to end up seeing that on campaign rallies across the country the next few months. They will not move a needle. And the more the elite engages and slams him on this press conference and engagement with Russia and try to promulgate further Russiaphobia, more of his base will completely turn that off. Now, the interesting part taking place the last few days and into the next several days is that Fox News itself, the channel that protects the president, is definitely their neocon faction in there is attacking him prolifically since this press conference. So that may change
Tucker,
things a little
to
bit.
To be fair, Tucker Carlson continues to travel down the straight line, and I give him kudos for that. He did an excellent job.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You know, Mary, let's get back to substance because, like Michael, I'm a policy guy. I like policy. Okay. All of this is great entertainment. You know, if you love or hate someone, it's still entertaining. You know, did you see the needle move at all for Syria, Ukraine, arms control? These are topics I'm interested in, and I would like to see addressed. Is your inkling that something has started, even if we use the term baby steps?
Yes, I mean, I think that quite a lot has actually started, and that, you know, if anybody actually listened or remembered what Putin was saying in his statement at the opening of the press conference, which has been practically written out of the script now because American domestic politics has taken over, there were some quite specific moves which I think at least make it possible that there can be advances. There was the question of Syria and the United States helping with reconstruction and setting up actual arrangements for that to happen. There was, I think, probably the most disappointing from my perspective was that I didn't see any real progress on Ukraine, although Putin really answered for Trump when he made clear that there were still disagreements and that Trump hadn't actually surrendered on the matter of Crimea, which is what people had suggested he might do in advance. I think there are going to be working groups set up on the various arms control treaties, existing ones that need to be continued, and maybe new ones in the pipeline. So I think there's been progress on all those areas, plus the actual fact that this meeting happened, so that an atmosphere and a dialogue of a sort has been established.
Momentum.
So I think we are further forward. I think we're further forward. Maybe not very much, but I think we are further forward.
Michael, basically the same question. I mean, you're a policy guy. I read your stuff. In the three areas that I mentioned there, has the needle been moved in your mind? Because, Putin was the one that brought up about Crimea. And, let me give an example for our viewers here. I think a lot of people don't know that after the Baltic republics were brought into the Soviet Union during the Second World War, the United States and its allies never recognized the Baltic republics as part of the Soviet Union. But they had arms control agreements, trade agreements. The leaders met each other. They had high points and they had low points. But that didn't stop that bilateral relationship. So why can't we do the same thing now? Okay, the United States and its allies do not recognize Crimea as a part of the sovereign state of Russia. But life goes on, and the people of the Crimea have already made up their mind. I mean, it seems to me common sense, but common sense doesn't prevail. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I agree with most of what you and Mary just said. I thought she did a very nice job of summarizing what we know about the policy discussions, especially on Syria, to some extent on Crimea. And your point's well taken that this is something that we can disagree about, but yet still contain. It doesn't have to dominate the relationship. I would like to see a fuller discussion on security in Eastern Europe, as you know, but maybe there were baby steps accomplished at least.
Let's go to Daniel. Daniel, I mean, how is Trump, I mean, does... In Trump's mind, was this a victory? Because I haven't read any tweets since the summit here. I mean, how is he going to sell this? Because I did notice, and we're rapidly running out of time, nobody in his inner circle has actually spoken to the press that I'm aware of. Go ahead.
I think the jury's out as to how he'll react and how he'll assess this over time. And if the elite media continues to assail him and his base stays with him, it'll be a victory. And I think on these key points, Syria, Ukraine, and arms control, we will know in weeks and months whether the needle has moved whatsoever. I think on Syria is where I'm the most cautiously optimistic that there may be some sort of path of agreement that we could move forward in the north and as well in the with the regime, but we shall see over the next weeks and months. And no matter what happens, from the UK to the US, we will still see proliferated across the news this attack, as well as Russia is, and Russia phobia is the enemy and the responsibility for anything that happened in our election to Brexit, instead of the internal review of looking inward as to government failing the people.
Let me close on these words here. When the debate is lost, slander becomes the tool of losers. Socrates. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the aftermath of the Putin-Trump Helsinki summit. We'll go through the firestorm and analyze what's going on.